It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right. Welcome. Man, it's good to have you here. It's kind of the weekend edition of Money for Lunch. This is our Friday show. And we tape our Friday show. We actually tape it on Thursday. That way, I can have a three-day weekend. It's selfish, I know. But, what are you going to do about it? Now, the great thing about, what do you call it, living in America is that we all get to have these choices. And, you know, probably Canada or, you know, the UK and a bunch of other free places. But you know what I'm talking about. I mean, that's one of the great things about being an entrepreneur, about owning your own stuff, is that you can make up the rules as you go along. All right. I was having an apple during the break there and getting a little throat tickle, so I apologize. I may have to hit the cough button a couple more times. So for the last couple of weeks, we have been taking a section out of the book called The 13 Things That Mentally Strong People Don't Do. This is what they don't do. And number 10 is going to be so appropriate for anybody who's trying to achieve anything. And that is, they don't give up after their first failure. I think that this should be they don't give up, period, right? So success isn't immediate. Failure is almost always an obstacle you will have to overcome. For example, Theodore Geisel, also known as Dr. Seuss, whose first book was rejected by more than 20 publishers. Dr. Seuss is now, of course, a household name. Thinking that failure is unacceptable or that it means you're not good enough does not reflect mental strength. In fact, bouncing back after failure will make you stronger. The book is The 13 Things That Mentally Strong People Don't Do. The author, Amy Morin, if you want to check it out. Let's go. Let's get started. Let's go to our first guest. I'm excited to bring him on, Mark Fechner. Mark, where did it go? Oh, there it is. Mark Fechner is certified professional coach and Energy Leadership Index Master Practitioner. Through the Institute of Professional Excellence in Coaching, a core values index certified practitioner through Taylor Protocols and a professional certified coach from the International Coaching Coach Federation, his experiences in the high-stress arena of trading was a great proving ground for working with individuals and teams in the areas of leadership, performance, and creativity. Mark Fechner, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you very much, Brett. It's a pleasure to be here. Oh, and I have to thank you for shortening my day by a day. So I appreciate that. Shortening my week by one day. I'm glad it's now Friday.
That's a great thing about this show. I mean, we really, what is it? Time. We alter time and space here on Money for Lunch.
I've walked into the TARDIS. Thank you very much.
That's right. Oh, my goodness. That's right. Nerds at Play. We walked into the TARDIS. I love that one. All right, so I got to ask you this. What in heck is an Energy Leadership Index Master Practitioner? I mean, that sounds like techno speak to me. You got to explain this one to me.
Absolutely. What that means is people engage in decision makings based upon really how they feel and how they approach decisions, how they approach activities. And we have a certain amount of energy that we engage with things. When we're really passionate about stuff, we tend to, you know, give that activity a lot more energy. When we're stressed, that energy gets divided. It's kind of like taking your fingers and jabbing yourself in between, you know, the two ribs on the side. You can do the activity, but you're distracted. My work, and this is where I got, you know, my training from the National Institute for Professional Excellence in Coaching, talks about, okay, what are those stressors? How is that affecting my decision process? How can I reroute my thinking so that I can be fully engaged in whatever the activity is that I want to go towards? We, as individuals, we tend to go through life kind of writing on default, on a default setting. And the work I do with my clients helps reroute some of that energy into a more active, engaged decision process.
All right. That's a lot of information there, but I appreciate that. And I like what you said, and I hope everybody picked up on that we make all our decisions based on how we feel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How we feel is more important than what we know, because you know that you love your kids and you love your spouse, but you come home and you're in a bad mood. You're probably not going to be showing them how much you love them, because you're coming home and you're going to kick the cat through the hedges and alienate everybody. You just failed in that moment because you were feeling poorly.
Right. Yeah. Well, and in reality, we create our own reality. So
yes,
intellectually we may know, yeah, I love my kids, yeah, I love my job, but the moment, the activity that we're doing in, the could create that kind of stress that just takes us out of where we really want to be. And that's kind of the work that I try to do with my clients.
All right, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about the difference between mastery mindset versus a performance mindset.
That's a great question. And actually, your the blurb you gave about the things that, you know, mentally strong people don't do, which is number 10 there, was, you know, they don't quit. That actually is a really good preface to understanding the difference between a mastery mindset and a performance mindset. So a performance mindset has by default an outcome. Let's say you are a salesperson and you're walking into a sales presentation. That presentation is, if you have a performance mindset, that presentation is either I'm going to get the sale or I'm not going to get the sale. Outcomes have a good or bad response to them. So either you get the presentation, that's good, or you get the sale, that's good, or you don't get the sale, and we tend to think that's bad. With that, there's a judgment attached to it, and all of those things can, and performance mindset also is fleeting. It's one event. It's one activity. So you contrast that with a mastery mindset. A mastery mindset has no outcomes. In other words, every activity you do is a learning experience. So that if I'm walking into a presentation and I'm going to make a sales pitch, that sales pitch I can learn from. If I get it, that's great. What can I learn from this? How can I duplicate this? If I didn't get it, okay, fine. What can I learn from it? Mastery mindset also gives you the opportunity to look at a more longer-term view. It's a repeatable process. There, since it's not attached to any one event, it's not attached to any one outcome, everything becomes a teachable moment. So that the blurb that you gave on mentally strong people, what they don't do, not quitting is part of that process. So that when you walk into a presentation, you walk into it saying, you know what, I'm going to do the best I can. You can come up with a plan as to, you know, what's my optimal goal, what's my minimal goal that I can walk away with, and it always comes out as something that you've learned from and is a benefit to you in how you interact with others, how you interact with your business, how you interact with your family, all of that stuff. It's a much more holistic, it's a higher level of thinking, achieves greater results and more sustainable
sure.
results.
Well, and so mastery is a long-term view, performance is a short-term view.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, so let me ask you this.
Yes.
What are the influencers, if you will, mm-hmm. that would detract from a leader's performance?
This is part of my coach training through IPEC. We are taught 6 different influencers, and those influencers are spiritual, mental, emotional, physical, social, and environmental. And each one of them have a different set of stressors attached to it. For instance, in a spiritual sense, if you're not connected to why am I doing this, what's my purpose behind going after this sales position, if you're not attached to some sort of higher goal, then it's going to be that's going to create a stress. It's like, well, why am I doing this? If that clarity isn't there, if you're not clear as to what are the steps I need to do to get to a particular goal, then that's going to create a whole other set of stressors. And stressors are like I described earlier, that, you know, those 2 fingers in the rib cage. They detract you from the activity you're trying to achieve. So it's instead of focusing 100% on a particular activity, now your focus gets bisected, for lack of a better phrase, and only part of your energy is now towards this is my activity. The other part is being drawn away by the stress. And so
understanding
what are the stressors that are affecting you can help you become more fully engaged in the activity that you're being presented with.
Gotcha. All right. Speaking of diverting my attention, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back with Mark right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back hanging out with Mark Beckner, certified professional coach. The other question I had real quick is, let's see, what was it that got my attention? Core Values Index Certified Practitioner.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about what that means. How does that work? If I'm your client, how does Core Values Index Certified Practitioner help me?
That's a great question. The Core Values Index was developed by a gentleman by the name of Lynn Taylor. They're located out of Washington State. And his index is, and these are all assessments that I use in my coaching practice, his index is about measuring how you're hardwired, how you show up in the world as a natural, just how you are. We all know people that are really, they're doers. They want to do, they want to make a decision, go on to the next thing, see what happens, make another decision. Then you have those people that are really, they like doing the research. They like doing the book work. They like going through the internet or going through the encyclopedias and finding the information. There are that whole, there's a whole range of people in that regard. Understanding, and again, this is all about sort of understanding who you are and helping you make better decisions. Understanding that aspect of who you are and how you engage with others is sort of the beginning of the conversation on how you can make better decisions. So when I use this in my coaching practice, it's sort of the first step. It helps engage and create that foundation for a conversation on creating a vision for the client, on helping them reach that vision, and then coaching them through the challenges on creating that. The energy leadership stuff, just as a contrast, is more about what's happening in the moment. Core values typically don't change because that's just who we are, but energy leadership changes, and it should change because that's what we have control over. It's how we perceive things, what our beliefs are, and how they're affecting our decision process.
No, I like that. I like that. And for our listeners, if you're not, what do you call it, hip to this stuff, you know, a lot of times we have this great goal in mind, but it conflicts with our core values, and therefore we have a really tough time achieving that goal, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we, you know, we kind of know to a certain degree, well, you know, I'm not a book person, or, yeah, I don't handle paperwork really well, or, you know, I'm not a creative. We kind of understand that, but in the context of a coaching relationship, it's helpful to have that third-party point of view, because as a coach, I'm impartial. I'm not asserting anything of my values. This is all about the client. This is me holding up a mirror for the client. And when we get into setting goals and coaching through the process, it's me helping them be accountable to what they want, not to what any agenda I'm trying to insert. Coaching is never about the coach. It's always about the client. And it's more important to understand, that about coaching than anything else. There's a lot of people in the world that say they're coaches, but they're kind of like mentors. They've done this, so therefore
Follow my lead kind of a thing.
Follow my lead, exactly. There are also people that call themselves coaches, but they're really consultants or they're great educators. And there's nothing wrong with any of those people. But a coaching is a very specific thing in that the coach is almost like a blank piece of paper for the client. And my job is to ask the questions to help the client reach the goals that they want.
Sure. Let me ask you this real quick.
Sure.
And I think that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I think that the thing that holds most of us back is fear, right? And
among other things, yes. Absolutely.
Among other things. But I think fear is the primary culprit. We sometimes disguise it in different ways, but I constantly say that it doesn't matter whether you're Donald Duck or Donald Trump, you have limits that you've set for yourself, and a lot of these limits are based on fear. So how do you, you know, deal with somebody, Mark, that is afraid to take that next step? You know, maybe it's write a book, maybe it's quit their job, maybe it's a relationship that they need to end. How do you help them get past fear?
Well, and that's a very good question, because we call it, I mean, we say fear of whatever, but fear is intensely personal. Your fear about writing a book would be something very different than perhaps my fear of writing a book. I dealt with this a lot when I work with financial traders. The fear of one, you know, most of these traders say, well, I'm afraid to get in the market, or I'm afraid to get out of the market, or I'm afraid to lose money. That's sort of the overriding premise. But when you start diving in, each one's fear, it's very unique, it's very personal, and there's no cookie-cutter solution for it. If I have a fear of writing, it could be a fear based upon, do I have anything to say? What do I have to say? Why would anyone want to listen to me? Whereas someone else's fear might be, could be fear of rejection. It could be fear of, not understanding the process and whatnot. It's fear is very, very personal. And so for any, for a coach, for myself at least, part of that conversation has to be, well, let's understand what it is that's driving you in this fear or what's stopping you in this fear.
I like that you pointed out that it's a personal thing and everybody's got their own little hang up with it. Mark, we're out of time. Would love to bring you back another time, my friend. Good stuff there. Been a lot of fun speaking with you. We'll have you back soon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Good stuff there from Mark Fechner. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then when we come back, we're going to hit it out of the ballpark with Kari Skloot. Ah, man, I messed it up really bad. But anyway, with our next guest.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
It's just so cool. You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Kari Skloot. I'm excited to have her on the show. Sometimes you get a name because of the way my mind works, you have to kind of have fun with it. So Kari Skloot will help you with your loop. That's how you're going to remember her name. And book 52 ways to based on creating and on your own balance. I like this so much. Your own unique life work balance.
Right.
Welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you for having me, Bert. I'm very glad to be on.
You bet. And so let me tell everybody a little bit about you. Life work coach. You help working moms reduce their stress and in turn find more energy and connection with many different aspects of their life and their work. After 25 years of working in organizations of all shapes and sizes, both profit and nonprofit, Kari has pretty much been there, done that, a mother of a 15-year-old son and married more than 26 years. She's a speaker, author, and certified life coach specializing in life-work balance. Again, I happen to be married to a woman, and of course, nowadays, that's not as funny as it used to be 10 years ago, but anyway, but what's interesting to me is, especially working moms, I think moms in general feel that they have to do it all, but working moms, I think, carry more baggage about that, and they seem to sometimes be afraid to take time for themselves. Do you find that to be true, or am I off mark?
No, I think you're absolutely right there. What I hear a lot of working moms say is, if I put myself first, I'm being selfish. Well, and that's just not the case. We have to think about it as, you can't pour from an empty cup. So if you don't take time for yourself, you're not going to have anything left to give to your family, to your job, and the like. So, no, that is, you're right on there.
Absolutely. And let me tell you, from my experience, for the ladies who are listening, for the working moms, your relationship between your husband and yourself is not going to be hurt by you taking time for yourself, but I think it's the reverse. If you exhaust yourself, and I like your analogy, you can't pour from an empty cup, then you know your zest for life, you know, you're too tired, you want to stay home, you never want to go on a date, you know, all that diminishes that relationship, and all of a sudden your marriage is in trouble.
Right, you're absolutely right. You know, when we look at the different areas of your life and your work, I've identified after doing some research 16 different aspects around your life and your work, and one of those aspects is that intimacy and romance. Whatever your primary, you know, relationship is, you have to pay attention to that too. Otherwise, your entire life and work can get off kilter.
Absolutely. All right, so let me ask you this. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot. Here you are, a life-work balance coach. And so, you know, the question I'm going to ask you, is life-work balance really possible? Can we, both men and women, can we really have it all?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and I get that all the time. And there are a couple different schools of thought on that, but the way I see it is absolutely life-work balance is possible. We just have to redefine what it is that we are calling balance. For example, if you look at balance as equal and putting it on that, you know, that that legal scale that you always see, that's not realistic because it is going to skew one way or the other at any given point in time. But instead, if we look at life-work balance the way we look at a well-balanced diet, you know, you're not saying that you're eating the exact same amount of protein and carbs, et cetera. You have a mix, and sometimes you have more protein with your meal, and other times you may be, you know, focusing more on your vegetables or focusing more on your dairy or whatnot. We're not saying that each aspect of your life and work needs to be the same. It just needs to work for you and create a well-balanced life work.
You know, and I want everybody to listen to this because I think it's so simple, as I believe all truths are, right? That it has to work for you. Your neighbors may have a different idea of what works for them, a work balance situation, but whatever works for you, and you don't have to apologize for it or feel awkward about it. It works for you.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I want to make sure that working parents really understand, is that this is personal. What is balanced for me right now is different than what's balanced for you, Bert. It's different than what's balanced for my husband. And another aspect to put in there is the concept of over a period of time. So if you have a really intense project at work right now for the next 2 weeks, you may be spending a lot of time and energy at work.
Right.
But knowing that once that project is completed, your energy and time may skew the other direction, which is good. You know, that's how we keep things balanced, by mixing and making sure that, you know, you have the time and energy for all the different pieces of you. And that is going to change. And also, we look at how it changes over the years. You know, when you're a parent of young children, your energy, your balance is completely different than it is once I have a teenager right now. His needs are completely different than they were when he was a toddler.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm taking him to different places. He needs me at different times of the day or for different things. You know, and that changes.
And one of the things I want to add in there, too, is that, and this is something that I've learned over my own experience, and again, it's customizable. Obviously, not everybody works the same way. But if I am working in a project where, you know, I'm going to be putting in a lot of late hours, or I'm traveling a lot, and what I found that works for me and really helps me recharge is taking some time off to reconnect with myself and my family before I go back into a new project or back to work.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And if that works for you and your career and you can fit that in, that's a wonderful way. You know, you need to identify what it is that does recharge you. For some people, getting away alone recharges them. For other people, maybe you have a hobby that you like to engage in, or, you know, take a recreational trip, a luxury trip, if you will.
Sure.
Find whatever it is that recharges you so that you can, you know, be a better parent, be a better worker, be a better you. You have to identify that, though, and do the work to find out what it is that will recharge you.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so let's do this real quick. I want to talk about maybe some of the myths of life-work balance, because I want to, you know, kind of get it, give me some of your input on this, because a lot of people that, you know, talk about that life-work balance is just a matter of time management or prioritization, or, you know, it's something else. So are there any myths that we should be aware of when it comes to life-work balance?
Those are really good points, and I do hear a lot, well, it's just about managing your time better, getting a good calendar system. And that's a very simplistic way to look at it. While that is an important factor for a lot of people, finding the right calendar system, time management system, it's much more than that. We get back to the point of where I said that return on energy. You know, what we're talking about when we're talking about balance is making certain that you are acting and behaving in a way that supports your contentment, the way that supports whatever your balance is. So if that means that you're that you need to keep everybody well organized and running on a tight schedule, and that works for you, fabulous. You know, if instead you find that you're kind of a go-with-the-flow kind of person, but it works for you, then do that as well. Don't be tied into thinking that it's just time management or just prioritization. It really is finding where that energy comes from. And that,
yeah,
where you can, you know, give the most and get the most. You know, I like to say we don't want to cram more into your life. We want you to get more out of your life.
I like that. Let's talk about this. I want to get your opinion on this. It seems to me that the issue of life-work balance, you know, is kind of making a resurgence, right? Because, you know,
yeah,
life-work balance has been around is almost as long as I can remember, but it seems like now more than ever it's being talked about all the time. What's your take on this?
Well, and it is being talked about much more frequently, and I think that's a good thing. You know, when I was growing up, it was rare to have two working parents where I grew up in small town Iowa. Well, now we know that 70% of all women with children under 18 are in the workforce. So the vast majority of moms are working. And that's not the case where it was when I was growing up. And 40% actually of those moms are the primary breadwinners now. So that's changing the complexity quite a bit. But we have wonderful conversations going on right now about flexible options in the workplace. So it's much more favorable to be talking about it. And I think then that gives working parents the permission to have those conversations with their employer, with each other, with their partner, and with their kids, that this is okay, it's normal, and actually it's making me a better parent. It's making our family stronger, and for the employer, making me a much better employee if I'm comfortable with this. So this conversation is great to have. And it really saw its resurgence with the book Lean In. You know, Sheryl Sandberg really brought this into the public forefront, not just something that HR people were talking about, but where,
right.
you know, those of us at large are talking about it.
Yeah, I thought she did a great job. And, you know, it's one of those things in our society, in all societies, where somebody who is deemed to be, quote, successful and respected says what everybody's been saying for years, but now it's like, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's important to realize that, yeah, she's at a different financial level than the vast majority of us are.
Right.
But that doesn't mean what she's saying isn't of value to the rest of us.
No, no.
You know, absolutely.
It's the opposite.
I'm
just saying because of the way she's esteemed in our society, it carries
mm-hmm.
more weight.
Right.
Which is good.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it opened the door.
Very good.
Yeah. Not so much open the door, but, you know, maybe reopen the door, so to speak, or brought more attention to it. Let's talk about this. When you're dealing with working moms, what are some of the big concerns that you hear on a regular basis?
It falls under that phrase, mom guilt. Moms thinking that, oh, I can't, well, like we talked earlier, I can't put myself first. I can't do things for myself because
right.
I don't have enough
mom.
Time. Yep,
right.
I'm a mom. That's the thing I've got to be first. You know, they say to me, oh, I can't be, you know, I can't get on that career path that I really want because I'm a mom. And they won't take me seriously in the workforce. Or I can't be the type of mom that I should be, baking the cookies and, you know, serving on the PTA if I'm working. Well, that's the biggest thing that I'm hearing from working moms, and it's just not so anymore. But if that's the way you're believing, we need to figure it out how to shift your thinking.
Right.
So that you can see that you can do what you want to do.
And I hope everybody picked up on that it's a matter of that, what do you call it, shifting your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
and that's all really what it is, because we see this happen all the time where somebody says, I can't do it, and somebody else says, you know, I'll at least give it a try, or I can certainly do it. And it's just a different mindset. If you were to give a piece of advice to working moms out there, what would that be?
I think the thing that I would tell working moms most of all is stop feeling guilty. Give yourself a break. If someone else came to you and said, I can't do this, I can't do that, I'm not able to be the mom I want. If your girlfriend said this to you, you would talk her out of it. You would say, no,
right.
wait a second, you can. So give yourself that same type of break. You know, we often, especially as women, we have a lot of negative self-talk.
We do.
And talk, yeah, we really do. You know, we talk ourselves out of things that we would talk our friends into.
You know, and
we
let
don't
me,
give ourselves that same type of support.
Yeah, and I want to illustrate this with a personal experience. Let's see. I asked my wife to go and buy herself a dress, right? And my wife, I think, is very typical of, you know, me last kind of mindset. And I said, hey, you know, here's the budget. Let's go buy you a new dress. You haven't bought one in a while. And I want to have I forgot what the situation was. And it wasn't necessarily a special event, but I just wanted her to go buy a dress. Just because, right, is primarily the reason. And so she goes, okay, and she comes back a couple hours later with a couple of bags of stuff from the stores that she visited. Not one thing for her.
Yeah.
Not one thing for her. And so what I did is I asked her to take the stuff back, which she wouldn't. So I took the stuff back. And we tried it again. Now, go and buy yourself a dress. And it's just this weird thing. I don't know where it comes from, where this me last kind of mindset, but it is really ingrained in, I want to say, most of the women that I come in contact with, and definitely ingrained in all the moms.
Right. Yeah, we are conditioned to think that once you become a mom, you put yourself last. And what we're not realizing is that's really doing a disservice to our children. Certainly it's doing a disservice to ourselves because, you know, we have individual needs and desires and skills and wants that we have a right to explore. You know, but once you become a mom, for some reason, you think that putting yourself last is the way to do it.
Absolutely.
We've just got to shift that thinking.
Absolutely. No, I agree with you. Hey, real quick, tell us a little bit about the book, 52 Ways to Define, Create, and Own your unique life-work balance. As I said in the beginning of the segment, this is a book that you came out with, but something I left out is that this is a guided journal. So walk us, you know, kind of tell us a little bit about it. What do you mean a guided journal?
Well, if someone is into journaling and they can just open up a blank notebook and start writing, that's fabulous. But the majority of us can't do that without some sort of prompt. You know, tell me what to write about and then I'll write about it. So that's what I mean by a guided journal. So each of these pages has a prompt, has something for you to think about and something for you to write about. So it guides you through that. And it also then is based on the life work wheel that I talked about earlier with those 16 different aspects of life and work that I've been able to identify. So, for example, one of the topics might be on value and recognition as something you want to write about. So the question then, the prompt is, remember a time when your partner or your parents said that they were proud of you. What was it for? Did they do this publicly or privately? What words did they use and how did you feel? So, again, it's shifting your thinking about each of these aspects, about what value and recognition means to you, and reminding yourself that it's okay to do so. So, yeah, there are 52 of these. It's designed to be like a weekly project, but if it's something that you feel it's a flow, you can just continue on. But, yeah, that's the guided part of it, the guided journal. And journaling is still really big.
Absolutely.
Because it works. It helps people. It helps you put your feelings on paper. It helps you process, if you will, what you're thinking and what's going on.
I love it. Kari Skloot, thank you so much for stopping by and teaching us about work-life balance. I think this is such an important field, especially for moms and working moms. Looking forward to having you back again.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. Good stuff there from Kari about your unique, custom-made, personalized work-life balance. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Steve G. Jones right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro
and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through.
So cool.
It's just so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All righty, folks. We are back. My next guest, regular contributor and a friend. Steve and I have been here on the show now for, I think it's been over a year now. And he's just what you hear on the radio show is what you see in real life. He's just a warm individual and always attracting good things into his life. C.G. Jones is a board-certified clinical hypnotherapist. He's been practicing hypnotherapy since 1980s, and he's the author of 22 books on hypnotherapy. He is a member of the National Guild of Hypnotists, American Board of Hypnotherapy, president of the American Alliance of Hypnotists, on the board of directors of the Los Angeles chapter of the American Lung Association, and the director of the California State Registered Steve G. Jones School of Hypnotherapy. In order to keep up with the very latest in research, he regularly attends training conferences. Steve G. Jones, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Well, thanks, Bert. Great to be here as always.
Hey, I got to ask you this. Here you are. You're on the board of directors of the Los Angeles chapter of the American Lung Association. What's the interest there? What got you involved with the American Lung Association?
Well, it's interesting. I was in a networking group when I lived in Los Angeles, when I was in I had my office in Beverly Hills, and they needed someone. A friend of mine who was in the networking group with me said they needed to kind of round out the board of directors, and they were looking into alternative health type people. So I showed up. I met with the president of the LA chapter. He liked me. He put me on the board. So that's what happened. And my interest is, you know, my father died from complications related to smoking. He was a smoker all his life. So about 12 years ago, he passed away because of that. So I've become very adamant about helping people stop smoking with the power of hypnosis and just educating them in general. The Lung Association, any groups like that are very interested in helping people understand how things like air quality and things that you do to yourself, like smoking and, things that are toxic in your home, how those things can really impact your health when it comes to breathing them in.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting it's an interesting story how things happen, because you're involved with a networking group, and somebody opens the door to you. And it's, as you said, it's also good because you're able to kind of, give back and in memorial of your father there. You know, my dad is he's 93, and he's been a smoker all his life. He's had some issues with smoking, and he cut way back. He was a two-pack smoker a day, and he's now down to a couple cigarettes a day and a couple cigars. And what's interesting to me, this is what I learned from at one point, both of my parents were smokers, and so this is when I realized that how you feel is more important than what you know. Because my dad is an academic. He can tell you what's in a cigarette. He can tell you how bad it is. He can tell you it's a gross habit. He can tell you all the stuff, but he still likes to smoke.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, they're from the same era. I guess your dad was born about 1923. My dad was born in 1925. So based on the age that you said, my dad would be about 91 if he is still alive right now. He would be exactly 91. And yeah. that era, they used to smoke everywhere. They used to smoke in airplanes. They'd have an ashtray in an airplane, on a commercial airliner. So it was just part of the culture, kind of like sunbathing. Sunbathing when I was growing up was the thing to do. Now we know that you need to cover up and avoid that as much as possible. So we've grown a lot in our knowledge over the years, but certain people who are born at certain times, just that's what they think. I don't know if they think of it like a vitamin or they think it won't hurt them. I mean, thank goodness your dad's still alive, so he's doing some stuff right. But overall, it takes a heck of a toll on the body, on all systems of the body, and it's much better not to do it.
Absolutely. And one of the things that when you look at that era when your dad and I were young, and a lot of people aren't going to believe this, but you can actually go on YouTube and see the commercials. And at one point, the cigarette companies literally got doctors to go on the air and say, hey, smoking is good for you.
Wow.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. Goodness. They have doctors, accredited doctors, saying, hey, you know, a smoke, you know, every now and then is not a bad thing. You know, I like to smoke two or three times a day. And so that's why I think it became so popular, because you had that seal of approval from doctors. And then, of course, it went rampant through Hollywood. All the tough guys smoked, you know. What's that guy? Dean, what is his name? Is it Jimmy Dean?
Oh, James Dean.
James Dean.
James Dean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jimmy,
yeah.
To his friends. And and so
there you go.
So you had all these tough guys. Bogart smoked. All the manly men in the world smoked. And a lot of people may or may not know this, but Tom Selleck, who's considered pretty much the image of a manly man, you know, his first job, Marlboro Man.
Wow. Well, luckily he survived. I know there's at least one Marlboro Man that didn't make it. Kind of like the Wendy's guy, the guy who started Wendy's, died. I mean, it's not a laughing matter, but he died of a heart attack in his 50s, if I'm remembering my facts right. So you eat a bunch of crap, or you breathe in things that you shouldn't. It's going to take a toll, and it's remarkable how far our knowledge has actually come in this, and thank goodness it has. I'm shocked that the medical industry was on board with that, but I guess with lack of knowledge and lack of data, there's ignorance, and now we know better.
Sure, and I think maybe that was part of it, but I think it was also the fact that they didn't regulate TV commercials back then. You know,
yeah,
and so...
And money talks.
You know,
sad to say.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, money talks. It's sad to say, but, you know, that's... I don't want to... I've had my run-ins with that kind of thinking, and... I could go into detail about stuff, but I'll spare everyone the sad details about how the big money machine will do its thing. But it's just a fact, you know. If they have the money, they can pretty much. Goodness, we're just overall more enlightened now, because eventually a preponderance of evidence just says, hey, that's insane. The smoking thing just isn't good for you. So eventually, logic and data win.
Sure. And what I find kind of interesting too is the extremes that the tobacco companies went to try to negate their knowledge. Oh, we didn't know, or they were pretty obnoxious about denying the ill effects of tobacco. But not that you and I were going to talk about the ill effects of tobacco, but what I do want to talk about is the whole deal that how we feel is so important to our success. Because we started talking about your father and I, my father and your father, and that was an era gone by. But there are people who are smoking today, millions of people who started smoking within the last few years, who know, hey, cigarette is bad for you. And if you've ever smoked a cigarette, it hurts, because you got to choke this down. And so my research, the research that I've been able to do, and I've interviewed over 1,000 smokers, it comes down to, in the most general sense, feeling loved. Some people call it being accepted. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be part of the. I wanted to be like everybody else. I wanted, you know, I all my friends were smokers, so I decided to try it. To me, I could categorize that as, you know, either wanting to be loved or feeling loved, or however you want to, you know, phrase that. But ultimately, some variation of love was the reason they started smoking. And then I did find a small group in my research of military people who started smoking. And this is, to me, just as dumb of a reason. But they started smoking because when they were in the military, the smokers got like a 15, 20-minute smoke break. And
yeah.
And the non-smokers were not allowed a break.
Wow.
Yeah, and going back to what you said earlier about being cool, you know, people start in high school because they can hang out with the cool crowd. So there are these quote-unquote benefits of smoking that people are attracted to, but it's really just a trap.
It is. It's amazing. And so, you know, going back to this is how we feel is so important. I mean, in the moment, how we feel is going to determine our decision. It's going to determine our level of success. For example, if you are tired, you're not going to do as well. What's the old adage? Fatigue makes cowards of us all. Another example, this is a personal on me. I remember when I was a young father, I would come home and I was just completely stressed out of my mind. And I would come home and my young children would be running to me saying, "Daddy's home, Daddy's home." And all I could do is bark at them because I was stressed out. And because I was young and dumb and inexperienced when it came to my kids, I would bark at them to leave me alone. Let me just get in the house and kind of, chill out for a little bit before you jump all over me, kind of a thing. And so between interviewing smokers and watching my own personal experiences, I realize that how we feel is more important than anything else. It overrides knowledge. It overrides anything else. And so, you and I have talked about how fear will hold us back and all these other emotions will hold us back. So this is my long way to get to this question is, how do we keep ourselves in a peak state so we don't bark at our kids, so we don't aren't going to go into, smoking or drinking or, bad habits. How do we keep ourselves in this mindset so where we can be better?
Wow, that's a big question. In my former life, I was a young father with a couple of kids and in my early 20s, and I was in the same boat, stressed out at the office and so forth, and coming home and not being quite as interactive as I, looking back, wish I had been. And I'm putting myself back in that situation. It's nice to apply the knowledge we have to the past, and it's easy to do that, to look back and say, hey, we should have done this. But looking back at myself in my 20s, I really think it comes down to just being open to this, first of all. I don't know if I would have even been open to that. I think the young me would have thought, no, you have to push harder and do more and achieve more and that kind of thing. That's just the mode I was in. And I've mellowed out a little bit since then, now that I'm almost 50. But I think it's a matter of really being open to things like, meditation and hypnosis and vacations. I remember I took one vacation in 6 years. I mean, I remember a stretch where I worked for 6 years straight. One vacation. I went to Jacksonville Beach for 2 days. And, that was it. Took the family there. But it's really a matter of just understanding the balance of life and understanding that studies do show that if you push versus push a little bit, take a break, push a little bit, take a break, the constant pushing is less effective, produces fewer results of the kind you're looking for than if you balance things out with, working, playing, because in that playing, you recharge, you get new ideas, you're refreshed, and you're much more likely to perform longer and better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up. we have this societal pressure, if you will, to especially if you're young, right, and you're trying to climb the corporate ladder, push, 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 and be aggressive, you know, pound the chest kind of a thing. And I like what you said about your example there that, hey, I didn't take a break for 6 years. And, you know, most likely it's not like your kids were saying, man, I hope Dad doesn't take another vacation this year.
Yeah, they want more. They appreciate it. And, you know, vacations when you have young kids are really valuable because they get to see more diverse things. I mean, they're not necessarily going to care about what you do or want to do what you do, but they do need exposure to the world at large so they can get their own ideas and see what they do gravitate to. And in an isolated, closed system, they don't have that. So that's one of the things that I think I know that I would have done much differently. I would have balanced that out, that work play, because it just would have benefited everyone much more.
Absolutely. No, I could not agree with you more on that. You know, the thing that's interesting is looking back, since we're looking back, I remember kind of what you said about being open to change. And I became aware that I was not, being as patient as I could. So that was I remember this awareness. And I can't remember where it came from. I don't know if it was a spiritual awakening or something. Just I realized that I just needed to be more patient. And I remember, praying, in the car or out loud or whatever, and thinking about this, that I wanted to have more patience. I wanted, you know, to be able to come home and not bark at people or my kids or my spouse and just overall just be a more patient individual. Well, again, this is back in the day when I was, I was really sucked into the whole corporate thing and I was doing mergers and acquisitions, and you can't be an M&A and not look the part, which, you know, you have to have custom shirts and custom suits and all this other stuff. And I remember picking up my son one day, right as I was heading out the door, and my son had what's called an LBM all over my custom shirt. Luckily, I didn't have my suit jacket on. And for those who are not familiar with the term, LBM stands for leaky bowel movement. So he had poured, his excrement had leaked out his diaper onto my shirt, and and I had it, luckily I was in the right frame of mind where I chuckled at it, because immediately when this happened, I remember thinking that I needed to be more patient. And what is, and as life will, often create the opportunity for what you need, right? So what could be a better opportunity to be more patient than to have somebody poop on you and then, being able to laugh it off, go back, change your clothes, and start over again. And so my point being is that is when I became aware of, at least one of my frailties, which is this impatientness that I had. And back to how we feel is more important than what we know, everybody has experienced at one point or another where their confidence made things happen for them. If you're a confident person, you don't mind taking chances. You don't mind speaking up. You'll raise your hand in class. You'll ask the girl out because you're confident. And so, I think confidence is one of those things that a lot of us are sorely lacking, or we might have confidence, let's say, in one arena, the office, but we have no confidence in a social setting, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, confidence is very powerful and very helpful. And I love the story. I didn't know the term LBM. Luckily, I never experienced one of those as a young father. That should be in a sitcom or something, or a movie scene. That's great. The only thing I have that can compete with that is and this is on YouTube, an interview I did for a TV station. My assistant was driving. I was running late, and I had some coffee, and I spilled it all over my pants. And when I'm sitting in the interview, and they're talking about a book that I wrote on hypnotherapy, and I'm sitting in such a way as to cover the large coffee stain on my pants. And that happens. And that showed me that I should prepare early. It was about 10 years ago, I guess. I was in my 30s. And just showed me I should prepare a little bit better and not run late. So I've learned my lesson there. But confidence is key in everything. And, you know, that's what helps you pull through when you get the LBM on your shirt or the coffee on your pants. You just keep moving forward and you look for ways that you can learn from that.
All right, so let me ask you this, because again, this is kind of your area of expertise. Is how do we, when I say your area of expertise, the mind, and the mind is so powerful. How can we go about developing our confidence? Because again, I like your whole coffee on the pants thing. A lot of people would have been so freaked out they would have canceled the interview. And you just went with it. You had enough confidence to say, hey, you know what, I'll just roll with it. And, you know, when you show up like that, you know, people, you know, things happen to put you in the best position possible. So any suggestions, any ideas for how to build your confidence?
Well, I think that it's really a matter of taking the time to find something that works for you, whether it's, you know, long-term talk therapy, hypnotherapy, meditation, just getting out there. For some people, that initial step is the hardest, and then after they're out there and more interactive, then it just accelerates. I remember a friend of mine I had, his name was Steve also, was in ninth grade. Before my parents sent me to military school, I was in public high school, and my friend Steve, who I became friends with, he was a bit of an introvert, and his parents actually thanked my parents for me bringing him out of his shell, as they said it. So we became good friends. He started becoming more socially interactive. And, you know, it's sometimes it's that kind of thing, just taking those first steps, becoming more social. It can be a bit of a challenge, but, you know, you really have to, unless you have a good friend who meets you and inspires you, you really have to do that yourself. You have to get out there and kind of fake it till you make it type thing. Just put yourself in those situations, feel the nervousness, feel the, you know, the lack of confidence, but realize that the more you do it, the easier it gets, the more people start to talk to you, the bigger your social circle grows, and it just kind of snowballs from there. So whether it's hypnotherapy or mainstream therapy or meditation or self-help books, you just need something to spark that thing and to keep going even when you don't feel it, and then it just becomes easier and easier.
Absolutely. I like that. I like what you brought up there as far as fake it till you make it. You know, one of the things I've learned from NLP, and I know this is one of the areas that you're an expert in, is that, you know, the way we move shows up, you know, emotionally for us, right? So how, you know, motion equals emotion. So you start walking around as you're confident, you stick your chest out and your shoulders are back, all of a sudden you feel more confident. And matter of fact, you know what, here's my last questions because we're going to run out of time. I want you to explain to the audience about anchors and how anchors work for us, because anchors, you know, can make or break a situation for us.
Yeah, well, anchors, the way that they're most productive and most practical is that you just think of a time that you did have your shoulders back. You did feel good about yourself just organically. Something happened. You walked a little old lady across the street, or you graduated kindergarten, or you graduated college, or you got married, or something that made you feel good. You put yourself back in that situation. You make the sight, sound, smells, taste, every sensory detail you can think of. You crank it up to a level 10 out of 10. And then you just do something basic, such as make the OK sign with your right hand, touching the tip of your right index finger to the tip of your right thumb, and say the word confidence when you're feeling that confidence that you felt back then. And then the next time you need to feel confident, you just make the OK sign with your right hand and say the word confidence, and you create a bridge to that time when you felt good, when you walked your shoulders back, when you felt great about yourself, so that you have the confidence from the past anytime that you need it.
That's a great explanation. And this thing about anchoring, we already are doing it. Certain smells will repulse us, or as you said, will send us back in time. There's certain smells that we all enjoy around Christmas. Why? Because it reminds us of our childhood, and so it changes how we feel. If I hear Boston play, the musical group Boston, it always reminds me of high school, and I automatically get good feelings. The same thing with the music Good Vibrations. So we're surrounded by these triggers or these anchors that set us off and make us feel good or make us feel bad, and sometimes we don't know why. And what I hope everybody picked up on this, what Steve, Dr. Jones, just gave you the formula is so you can make yourself feel good whenever you want. So you can go around saying okay, or you can go around saying confident, and all of a sudden your body changes and your shoulders go back, and you get all this, and you get a surplus of confidence because you've trained yourself psychologically and you've trained yourself both physically and mentally.
Physiologically, there you go.
Thank you. Good thing for the thesaurus. Anyway, so bottom line is you can do that. And I also want to talk about this because Steve has the world's largest audio library, clinical hypnotherapy library at stevegjones.com. And he's got, I don't know, a dozen, maybe half a dozen or so, audios on just confidence. Not just confidence, but there's confidence in dating. Program yourself for confidence, unlimited confidence. And so right there, I use Dr. Steve G. Jones's audios. My wife uses them. I even got some for my kids to help them with their grades. And so this is stuff work. I absolutely believe in it, or I wouldn't be telling you about it. And so you can go there, stevegjones.com. There's three or four things that I see that deal with confidence, and there's probably more once you get in there. You know, there's just so many things that Steve has. And the great thing about it is, because I know this answer because Steve, I've asked Steve this question, he doesn't just sit there and try to come up with things. He also gets feedback from people like me and his other, you know, tens of thousands of customers that tell him, hey, we want an audio on this, and he'll produce it if he gets enough requests. So stevegjones.com is the place to go to help you build your confidence, as well as some other audios there that might be of benefit to you. Steve G. Jones, I want to say thank you to you, my friend, for stopping by and helping us out today. Looking forward to hanging out with you here in 2016.
Oh, Bert, I'll look forward to it also. Thank you very much.
You bet. Good stuff there from Steve G. Jones. And today we're talking about how you feel is more important than what you know, specifically confidence. What would your life be more like? What would your life be more, or how would your life be improved if you had confidence? You can have more confidence, and you can achieve your goals quicker, faster. You can have more fun in life, and you can do it. You can train yourself to be more confident. You can listen to Steve G. Jones on his audio series there at stevegjones.com. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.